We're beginning our study of Ezekiel. And before we jump in, I'd actually like to spend a few minutes before we even start reading the book to sort of, I think it would benefit us to be reminded of and to set the stage for the time that Ezekiel's prophesying. Now, if you've been with us on Thursday nights and you've gone through 2 Chronicles with us, most of this will be fresh in your memory. And for those of you that weren't, here's a brief synopsis. King Solomon, you've heard of Solomon, rich guy, wise guy. I mean, not like a, you know, tell you a pun sort of wise guy, but very, you know, wisest man in all the earth. After he died, Israel was rocked by a civil war, and it was split into two separate nations. Israel became the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel under two different kings, King Rehoboam and King Jeroboam. So there's two different ones. That's why when you read the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, you're always so confused because it's like, wait a second, I thought this guy was king. No, this guy's king. Well, this guy's king. That's because the book of the Kings is telling you all the kings from both of the nations, and they're overlapping one another. And that's why then after reading Kings, you read Chronicles, and you say, wait a second, this all sounds very familiar. Well, the Chronicles are the Chronicles of just the kings of Judah, the southern kingdom. So that might help to explain a lot of stuff in your Bible reading that maybe you've been confused about. But they went down through history as two separate Jewish nations, the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, the northern kingdom of Israel had horrible kings. I mean, just the names list of kings, you would have to write good or bad next to all of them. You just write bad, 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 bad next to the northern kingdom's kings, king after king after king. Just each one seemed to be worse than the last, and it was just horrible. And finally, God said, enough is enough. I've warned you enough times. We've gone through all these years. I've tried to show you grace. I've tried to show you mercy. So now you're going to get justice. And he let the Assyrians come in and wipe them out. The Assyrian Empire came in, and it was called the Assyrian Captivity, but God promised through the prophets that they would die in captivity. They're not coming back. The only representatives of those 10 tribes that made up the northern kingdom that survived were the ones who had long ago said, you know, Judah is more righteous. We're moving down there. So all 12 tribes are still represented in the southern kingdom, but the majority of the 10 tribes up in the north wiped out, never to be heard from again. They didn't become the 10 lost tribes and go to, you know, Denmark and Sweden and all these places. They're gone. So now the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom throughout history had mostly bad kings, but every once in a while they'd get a good king, somebody whose heart was for God. And we think of guys like, most recently we saw Josiah, and before him there was Hezekiah. And so there was a handful of these kings that brought about revival, that would restore the temple and bring back the sacrifices and start up, you know, Passover again and things, and tell people you've got to obey the word of God. And so that worked. Jehoshaphat or Jehoshaphat was another one of those guys that had done that. And so there's a handful of these guys, but judgment was coming anyway because the majority of the people were wicked. They didn't have a heart for God. And after Josiah died, the succession of kings was horrible. And finally God said, okay, that's it. Only this time I'm not going to use the Assyrians. I'm going to use the Babylonians. The Assyrian Empire had been replaced by the Babylonian Empire at this point, and they were the world power. And so the Babylonians came down into invasions into Judah and specifically against Jerusalem, and on three different occasions attacked the city and took people captive and stole treasure and everything else. It's actually kind of important to keep track of those, of the dates and what exactly was happening when King Nebuchadnezzar, this was the king of Babylon, attacked. The first attack was in 605 BC, and that was when Jehoiakim was the king. And 2 Chronicles 36, we read that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against him and bound him with bronze chains to take him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also brought some of the articles of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his temple at Babylon. So here's the first invasion in 605. We've taken the king captive. his son Jehoiakim, sounds the same, but there's a different letter at the end. Jehoiakim, taken into captive. Jehoiakim becomes the king. He's this 18-year-old kid that becomes king of Judah. Second attack takes place a number of years later in 597 BC. And again, Nebuchadnezzar attacks Jerusalem, and Jehoiakim, the king, is taken captive, and as well as the rest of the temple treasures, everything that was valuable in the temple. And then we read, and it's a little bit fuller in 2 Kings, so I'll read you 2 Kings 24. He led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and the smiths. The Joneses got left behind, but the smiths got taken. None remained except the poorest people of the land. So he led Jehoiakim away into exile to Babylon, also the king's mother and the king's wives and his officials and the leading men of the land. He led away into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. All the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen and the smiths. You see, the smith, no, just kidding. 1,000, all strong and fit for war, and these the king of Babylon brought into exile into Babylon. So this is what we think of generally as the Babylonian captivity, although there was three of them, this was the big one. Now, a few years later, in 586 BC, the third attack came, and this wiped out the city. 2 Kings 25 says, he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Even every great house he burned with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Then the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon, and the rest of the people, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away into exile. So now the rest of the people get taken into exile. Ezekiel was the son of a Levitical priest. A reputable family would have been taken into captivity during the second attack. And as we're going to see, that there was a lot of false prophets among the people in Babylon. They had gotten taken in 597. And for 13 years, they were telling the people, hey, you know, it's going to be okay. This is just a hiccup in Jewish history. Don't worry. Now, Jeremiah had said it was going to be 70 years. But, oh, they said, Jeremiah doesn't know what he's talking about. We're going to be here. You know, don't even bother to plant a garden. Don't settle in. We're going to be here for a few weeks, a few months, and then we're going to go back. Well, Ezekiel, we're going to see in his ministry, from the time that he's called to prophetic ministry until the time that third attack and the total destruction of Babylon takes place, Ezekiel's going to be saying, oh, no, we're not going back. No, not for a good long while. And that, when it happens, when the destruction of Jerusalem happens, essentially what happens to Ezekiel is he gets credibility. Nobody's been believing him all this time. Well, now we see, wow, he's been telling the truth. And so that's when he starts to prophesy about Israel's glorious future that God has planned for her. So that's kind of the scenario and the setting of the timing of the book. At this point, as we pick up in chapter 1, Ezekiel's been taken into captivity in this attack in 597, in this second attack. And he is in Babylon, and we're going to see in the first three chapters his call. He was the son of a Levitical priest, and so he should have expected that if he was still in Jerusalem, he was going to become a priest when he hit the proper age of 30. But now he's in captivity, and he's going to become a prophet, and he didn't even know it. So let's see. Let's start with chapter 1, verse 1. That's a good place to start. Now, it came about in the 30th year, on the fifth day of the fourth month, when I was by the river Kabar among the exiles, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's exile. The word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kabar. And there the hand of the Lord came upon him. So here's the story. It's in the 30th year. People have debated about what that means. The most obvious thing seems to mean it's when I turned 30 years old, is what he's saying. It came about in my 30th year. It was when I turned 30. And this is 5 years into the exile. You notice Jehoiakim's exile had happened at the same time as Ezekiel's did, 597 BC. And so now, this is 5 years later. He's turned 30 years old. And he gets this vision. Now, where is he living? He's living in Babylon in what you could, I guess you could call kind of a refugee camp. The Babylonians had settled the Jews next to the river Kabar in a place called Tel Aviv, not the capital of Israel today, totally different location, but same name. And so he was there and, you know, minding his own business, just kind of going on with life. Interesting, though, that he's been in captivity for 5 years, and he might have actually been kind of bummed because he turned 30 this year, and he might have thought, man, if we were back in Jerusalem, I would have got to be a priest this year, because you weren't allowed to serve as a Levitical priest until you were 30, even though David had lowered the age of the Levites that served from served in the temple from 25 down to 20, you still couldn't be a priest until you were 30. And so he might have had a little pity party as he had blew the candles out on his cake or something. But interesting that, I don't know, I think I'd rather be a prophet than a priest. You know, more personal interaction with God and less blood. And so it just reminds me that, you know, God's plans are better than our plans. Even the things we expect, even the things we've planned out. Well, I'm going to get this degree and then I'm going to get this job and I'm going to do this. It's like God says, yeah, man makes his plans, but I ordain his steps. And so we can have a pity party that, oh, I didn't get that job or that didn't work out, but God's got it all worked out. So in his 30th year, he gets this vision of God. And it says that he saw visions of God. Actually, even before he saw visions of God, it says the heavens were opened. The heavens were opened. I've always wondered what this looks like. The heavens were opened. And the more you study it, the more you realize it never really gets described in the Bible. It's just, it's either it's not for us to know, or it's an assumption that, well, sure, everybody knows what it looks like when the heavens are open. But every time you see that expression, it happens periodically throughout the Bible. It doesn't really explain what it looks like, but it does tell us very clearly that when the heavens are open, it's visible. You can see that all through the Bible. No pun intended. You can see that. No pun intended. Second time, pun was intended and still not gotten. So, the heavens are opened. You know, when Jesus was baptized, the heavens were opened. And it was visible. You know, immediately coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens opened and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him. And Jesus told Nathanael, you know, when he was calling the various disciples, the 12 disciples that would become apostles, you know, and be part of the of Jesus' ministry, he told Nathanael, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Again, it's a visible thing. And John in Revelation saw the same thing. He saw heaven opened, and this is when Jesus is coming back to the earth and going to conquer and rule and reign. John said he saw heaven open to behold a white horse and he who sat upon it. So it's a visible thing, but what it looks like what is not really clear. Now, fortunately, Ezekiel is going to explain a lot of what he sees. And I say, fortunately, kind of tongue-in-cheek, because if you've read ahead in chapter 1, you say, it doesn't matter that he explained it. I still don't understand what it looked like. So when the heavens were opened, Ezekiel saw visions of God. And visions of God. And another topic on which I am an expert. it's like people ask me all the time about visions of God. You know, it's like, what do they look like? How do you get them? You know, how do you interpret them? How do I know if I really had one? And I can always answer that one. How do I know if I really had one? If you're asking that question, you haven't had one. You know, it's like people, well, I wrote down this dream that I had and I don't know if it really, trust me, believe me, biblically, everybody who has a vision from God knows it. It becomes very clear, and it radically changes their life and changes their demeanor immediately. Visions, everybody craves them, it seems. You know, it's like you read that and you go, man, I wish I could have a vision from God and stuff. And I can tell you that biblically, anytime somebody has a vision from God, the word of the Lord or the directive of the Lord is given to them. And so it makes it like a neat sort of thing, except I don't think visions from God are really what we're supposed to be coveting. Because you might remember a little incident with Moses' brother and sister, Miriam and Aaron. They had a little bit of a problem with Moses, and God spoke to them. And in Numbers chapter 12, God said to them, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He's faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth or face to face, even openly, not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord." And so what God is saying is, Moses isn't just some prophet that I give visions to. I talk with Moses face to face. Not like the visions of dark sayings and dreams and that kind of stuff. I'm having conversations with Moses. What God is saying is, having a conversation with me is far superior than me giving a vision to you. Visions are described as dark, you know, dark sayings. They're sort of mysterious. They're not real clear. You don't get to ask questions. You know, it's not like a two-way conversation very often. And it's mysterious, and it's often kind of disguised in imagery and things. And so it's, God describes it as dark as opposed to talking to somebody face to face. Well, we as Christians have a relationship with God, or I should say we have the opportunity that we have the choice to have a relationship with God where we talk to him, where we talk to God, and his word gets given to us and we talk to him, and that's, it's far superior than visions, believe it or not. And so people striving for visions, you know, I'd rather spend an hour reading the word and another hour in prayer, or maybe 2 hours doing both simultaneously than waiting around for a vision. And I don't know how you get a vision anyway. It's not like you can muster it up. It's not like you'd say, well, maybe if I, you know, only drink Gatorade for the next 2 months and Snickers bars. Yeah, I bet you'll have a vision. I mean, I don't know that it's going to be from God, but yeah, you'll probably have a vision. So you can't make God give you a vision anyway. So, and so it says that the heavens were open, he saw visions from God, and it says the word of the Lord came expressly to him. This is interesting, because we've already seen, and for you note takers, if you want to write down the visions, that visions, the word of the Lord comes to you, Genesis 15, I think, is the first place where that's described as happening, Genesis 15, 1. But in Ezekiel's vision of God, the word of the Lord, it says, came expressly to him. Came expressly is a single word in Hebrew. And it's a hard translation. It means came or became or happened. So you could almost, I mean, you could almost throw in there and say the word of the Lord happened to Ezekiel the priest. You know, it's like it just suddenly was. The word of God just suddenly was. Like it happened to him, or it suddenly existed for him. I don't really know what the proper way to translate this is. I know all the translations fall short, but it was just like, it's like the word of the Lord happened to him. It just suddenly existed for him. And I imagine that when we, you know, hear of those miraculous things, the spiritual gifts, like the word of knowledge, you know, or the word of wisdom, how suddenly those things, you know, it wasn't for me. It just appeared in my head. It was just, I knew that's what I had to say. I guess prophecy would be like that too, where I wasn't thinking that. I didn't have any foreknowledge of that, and yet it was just there. I imagine that the word of God just happened to him just like that. And so when it says came expressly, that's really what it's trying to get across there. So the word of the Lord happened to him, or suddenly existed for him. It came expressly to him. And mentions that Ezekiel, the priest, Now, he hasn't been practiced as a priest, but he has the right of being the priest because his father was Boozy, you know, which he was in AA and he was working it out. But, sorry. Sorry. And so, you know, God looked at him as having that divine right, whether the temple was in operation or not. God looked at him. So he's actually a priest and a prophet. So after what you might imagine him having a pity party that he wasn't anything, suddenly he's both things. Now, it says that there the hand of the Lord came upon him. The hand of the Lord came upon him. I often think of the hand of the Lord coming upon me in kind of a sort of a clenched fist and rapid speed, you know, sort of, you know, that's sort of the way I expect God to deal with me. And yet biblically, that's not what the hand of the Lord is. When somebody places their hand on you, biblically speaking, they're imparting something. You know, when the elders lay hands on a person, it's for the purpose of imparting healing. When Moses was told to lay his hands on Joshua and on the elders, it was to impart his authority. And so, you know, even when the sinner comes to the temple with his sacrifice, he confesses his sin and lays his hand on the head of this sacrifice. He's imparting the spiritual guilt, essentially, of the sin to the beast that's going to be slain. So it's an imparting of things. Now, and spiritual gifts, you know, same sort of things, laying by, you know, that was imparted to you by the laying on of hands, as Paul reminded Timothy. So when God lays his hand on you, it's an impartation. It's an impartation of blessing. It's an impartation of authority or empowerment to be able to do that. And you can go through the scriptures and just study that phrase about God's hand being on somebody. And you see that when God's hand is somebody, they can speak forth his direction. It's like they can speak for him. They, you know, they get the word of the Lord and are able to speak on God's behalf. Also, and this is interesting, if you look in the book of Ezra several times, Ezra notes how things are just working out. You know, it's like, man, the king, you know, did this for me and I wasn't expecting it. And this other guy, you know, they sent this man of insight to me and he gives credit for it every time when circumstances just work out well in the world. Because the good hand of my God was upon me. That's the deal. When God's hand is upon you, things are just working out. You know, you ever have that stuff where it's like, wow, I didn't know that was happening, but this just worked out. We call them coincidences or, you know, boy, that was lucky or whatever. Well, it's the hand of God. No such thing as luck and no such thing as coincidence. The rabbis have an old expression that says, coincidence is not a kosher word. It's not biblical. But the good hand of my God working all things out by divine providence, that's biblical. Also, when his hand is upon you, you're strengthened to do his work, and he prepares you to do it. Now, that's not always the same thing. Sometimes it's strengthening, like, wow, you know, I'm empowered to do this. Sometimes the preparation is a good squashing. You know, it's a good, you know, squeezing out the last few bits of you so that you can decrease and he can increase. That's when God's hand is upon you, it's to prepare you to do his work, but that's not always preparation like we, you know, it's kind of like boot camp. If you guys have been in the military and you went to boot camp, they kind of had to wring you out to build you up. You know, you kind of had to be a lot less of you to be more of the military. So, that's all that the hand of the Lord came upon him. It says, and as I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually and a bright light around it, and in its midst, something like glowing metal in the midst of the fire. Now, it's difficult, you know, living here, it's difficult to describe for you wind and storm clouds. yeah. I didn't know what wind and storm clouds were till I moved to Cheyenne, Wyoming. And now, you know, you can, it's amazing that, you know, it seems like every day about this time of year, you know, the day's been nice, it's been pleasant, and things sort of get dark real quick. And at the trailing edge of a thunderhead coming in, I mean, the wind just picks up and things start shaking and rattling and rolling and stuff, and trash cans rolling up the street and things. And you know the storm's coming, and then you look and there's that thunderhead coming in, and you know you're in for a show. Or a call to your homeowner's insurance agent because the roof is leaking. But the description of this is a little bit different. Now, the storm wind was coming in from the north and a great cloud. We can picture that. No doubt Ezekiel had seen clouds before. He describes this as a great or a massive cloud. So this is an impressive, if you picture a thunderhead, you know, with wind leading in and then a thunderhead, you got to picture the biggest one you've ever seen or the most impressive one you've ever seen at least. And then it says a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually and a bright light around it. Now, we have seen the thunderheads that sit over Cheyenne. If you ever time it right, you're driving up, you know, driving north from Colorado and you see the thunderhead sitting over Cheyenne, and it's like people up in the cloud are plugging in and unplugging lights somewhere on the inside. You know, you see it looks fake. It's, you got flash, flash, flash over here, flash, flash, coming from the inside, like lightning's happening all inside and it's flashing and you do see lightning and things. And most Bible commentators say, well, yeah, this is a thunderhead, you know, a thunderstorm. Well, it's not. It doesn't mention lightning here. The fire flashing forth, when you're reading about fire flashing forth from a cloud, you say, oh, that's real quaint. That's Bible-ese for lightning. No, there's a lot of Hebrew words for lightning, and this isn't one of them. This word is fire. This is fire flashing forth from this cloud, actual fire. Now, I don't know if it's poofs of fire or streams of fire or, you know, balls of fire. I don't know what it is, but I do know that it's fire and it's not lightning. And because we're going to see lightning happen a little bit later in this chapter. And so there's fire flashing forth from this, you know, this storm wind, huge cloud, fire coming forth from it, and a bright light around it. The word around describing the circumference or the outside of it. And so it's not like a thunderhead where you see it flashing and glowing from the inside. This is light around it. And then in its midst, something inside of it is glowing metal in the midst of the fire, it says. Now, if you're reading a different translation, it may be very different than that. And in its midst, something like glowing metal in the midst of the fire. There's a lot of different ideas, and the Bible translations are all over the place about what this means. I'll give you a handful of them. I'll give you six of them. We just read one of them. The New Revised Standard says, and in the middle of the fire, something like gleaming amber. Well, amber and metal, that's a little bit different, you know. And the NAS kind of gave us the impression it was in the midst of the cloud itself. Well, the New Revised Standard makes it sound like it's in the midst of the fire. NIV says the center of the fire looked like glowing metal. So that kind of combines two of those and puts it in there. New Living Translation, not always the best thing to translate for literal interpretations, but I'll throw it out there anyway. The fire inside the cloud glowed like gleaming amber. King James, and this is why I don't read King James, and out of the midst thereof is the color of amber, as in the midst of the fire. Like, what? Out of the midst thereof? What does that mean? How can you be out of the midst? I mean, you're either in the midst or you're not in the midst, but how can you be out of the midst thereof? I don't know. Anyway, and New King James says, and brightness was all around it and radiating it out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. So that covered all the bases and said it was mid in the midst of the cloud and in the midst of the fire. And in that case, amber was thrown in there as well. The difficulty of the translation in this is because the Hebrew leaves it open as to the preposition of what's it in the midst of the cloud or the midst of the fire. Also, the Hebrew word that's translated gleaming amber or glowing metal or as the color of amber, as we saw in King James, New King James, it's a single word in Hebrew, and its meaning is unclear, and it only shows up in the Bible three times, and wouldn't you know it, all three times are in Ezekiel. So we don't really get an opportunity to compare a lot of different meanings. So some scholars think that the word refers to amber. And you know, amber, if you're a Jurassic Park fan or something, you know that amber is the fossilized resin of ancient trees. And it comes in a lot of different colors and varies in transparency and things. Others think that the word speaks of electrum. Electrum. Now, electrum is an alloy. It occurs naturally. It's a mixture of silver and gold and some other, you know, metal spices thrown in there. But it's essentially a mixture, naturally occurring mineral of silver and gold mixed together. And it usually looks pale yellow or yellowish white. And so it's kind of all over the map as to what this means. And since we don't know what it looks like, you know, that was 10 minutes on concluding that we have no clue. Anyway, so in its midst, something like glowing metal in the midst of the fire, if we don't know what it looks like, can we know what it is? Well, as we go through the rest of this chapter, and actually I should let you know, in case you're wondering, you know, wow, we're in trouble, we're only in verse 4. We're only going to go up to verse 21 tonight, but in chapter 1, what you see in this cloud is we're going to see that there's four living creatures, and there's four wheels associated with these creatures, and there's some other stuff flashing around, and then there's a big expanse, and then there's the throne of God and God on the throne. So there's a lot of stuff in there, and so it's very possible that this storm cloud coming in, you know, wind came in, big cloud comes in, fire flashing forth, and in its midst, whether you picture it like a big orb or he could just tell something's in the cloud, it's possible that from far away as it's coming in, he's describing all of it. He's saying, you know, I couldn't see what it was when it was far away, but it looked like amber or gleaming metal or whatever. Or he could have been describing one of these things individually. My thinking is he's seeing from a distance the scene of the cherubim and the wheels and the stuff flashing around and the expanse and the throne and God, you know, coming in, and it all looks like glowing metal to him. So, verse 5, within it, there were figures representing four, or resembling four living beings, and this was their appearance. They had human form. Each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hoof, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, were human hands. As for the faces and the wings of the four of them, their wings touched one another, and their faces didn't turn when they moved. Each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each one had the face of a man. All four had the face of a lion on the right and the face of a bull on the left, and all four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each had two covering another being and two covering their bodies. And each went straight forward. Wherever the spirit was about to go, they would go without turning as they went. You know, I'd like to see video of this. I mean, there's no way to read this. Every single time I read this, I get a different picture in my mind. Once again, just reading this out loud, now I have a different picture in my mind. I want to see a Polaroid. There's no way, I think, that we can really describe any of this other than what he says, and you kind of put it together as you will in your head. But it does tell us there's each one of these living beings has four sides, which means that it's got four faces, and you know, if you picture front, left, right, and back, and so it's got four sides, but then it's also its body must have four sides because it's got four wings, and under each of these wings there's a hand. Now, I don't know if that's like just a little jobby, you know, like that kind of thing, like Tyrannosaurus Rex kind of deal. Or, you know, if there's a hand coming out from under the wing, or he's talking about the arm, and of course you have to have an arm because there's hands. I don't know. But there's four of them and four hands under, or a hand under each of the wings. And it describes when they move, they don't turn. I guess that's the advantage of having four faces. You're always facing forward, you know. Forward. Yeah, there you go. So I want to go left, you know, I just go that way. I'm going forward because my face is there. Well, I want to go this way. My face is going. And so they move without turning. It's not like they have to turn and move. They just move around. So I don't know if I have enough time. I'll leave this to you, Bible students. The four faces, these beings that are in God's presence all the time, and we'll get into this a little bit, but these beings that are in the presence of God all the time, I think they're radically reflecting God's nature because their faces appear, one as a man, one as an ox or a calf or a bull, however you translate that, one as a lion and one as an eagle. And I think that's reflecting the nature of God because if you look at it, you know, God is, he's the Son of Man. But then you have the divinity part, you know, the eagle is the divinity part, but then you have the king part, which is the lion, but then you have the servant, you know, as God made himself a suffering servant in the form of a calf or an ox or a bull, a beast of burden, essentially. And it's interesting as you think that through, that's kind of the four sides that were shown of God in the Gospels, because Mark, the Gospel of Mark, presents the suffering servant aspect nature of Jesus Christ. Luke presents the man, Jesus Christ, the Son of Man. Matthew presents the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. He's the King of Israel. And then John presents the Son of God, the eagle, if you would, the divine side of Jesus Christ. So I think that they appear this way because they're reflecting the nature of God in his deity, in his kingship, in his humanity, and in his servanthood. But, you know, you can trace all that down, and maybe I just did for you. I don't know. So as we continue reading this, if you peek ahead to Ezekiel chapter 10, you're going to see almost the same scene happen again. And there we're going to find out a number of things, not the least of which is that these living beings are called cherubs, or in Hebrew, it's cherubim. I am making it plural. So it's the cherubim or cherubs. These guys obviously don't look anything like the cherubs that you might be used to hearing about, you know, in the paganism, that little, you know, the fat baby in the diaper with the bow and arrow. They call that a cherub. He's got a couple little wings, you know, he's like Cupid or whatever. That's what the world thinks of as a cherub. Well, these guys are pretty scary, and they're not babies in diapers with a couple of wings and a bow and arrow that makes you fall in love when you get hit by the arrow. These are some pretty impressive, creatures. Now, so these are the cherubim, and the cherubim, you know, John saw this same scene, when he was caught up into the throne room of God and saw surrounding the throne these same four living creatures. Now, John, from John's perspective, because John only stayed in one place, remember, these guys don't turn. They face one direction, and if they want to move, they go in the direction of whatever face. John's in one place, and he sees the four creatures. But since they're all facing the throne of God, with each one, he sees a different face. So John doesn't describe, I saw four guys with four faces each. He said, I saw these four creatures, and one had the face of an eagle, and one had the face of an ox, and one had the face of a lion, and one had the face of a man. Because where he was standing, he could only see the one of each one. So, interesting enough. And, excuse me. So these are cherubim. Ezekiel saw them. John saw them. Moses was given a model of them. Remember, Moses was supposed to make a model of the throne room, of God in the tabernacle. And God's throne was represented by this model of the Ark of the Covenant with the gold lid on top of it called the mercy seat. Made out of the gold in the mercy seat were these two cherubim. Now, there's only two. It was like a two-dimensional representation, if you would, with the wings extending out and covering. And Exodus 25, Moses got the instructions for that. And the wings of the cherubim, it said, have their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings. So these cherubim, represented in sculpture out of gold on the mercy seat, representing God's throne, extend their wings out. This is what the cherubim do, is they cover the throne of God. They extend their wings out and cover the throne of God. Now, that's really interesting to me because Satan used to be a cherub. Satan was one of the cherubim. And specifically speaking, God said, and we'll see this in Ezekiel in, let's see, chapter 28. I'm thinking that's around 2007. We'll get to chapter 28. God says to Satan after his fall, "You were the anointed cherub who covers, and I placed you there." It would seem by reading that not only was Satan a cherub, one of the cherubim, but that he was originally one of four, one of the four that surrounded the throne and covered the throne with his wings. Obviously, he became full of himself, got prideful and pompous and fell, but it seems that he was one of the original four cherubim, if you would. And so it's likely that was not only do we see he's a cherub, but that he was one of the four that covered with his wings the throne of God. Verse 13 says, "In the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and lightning was flashing from the fire." Now, going back and forth between the four cherubim is something that's described as looking like coals of fire or torches. And they're moving really fast, just between all the four. And when I read this, I picture, you know, on the 4th of July, when you're a kid, you get those punks, you know, the guys with the mohawks that listen to loud music. No, the punk is that burning. It looks like a really long, thin cigarette that you use to light the firecrackers. Well, it's always burning at the end. You know, it's always got that orange coal, and it's dark at the 4th of July. And so you could spin it in a circle and it makes like an orange circle in there. Or you zigzag it, or you try and write your name as fast as you can. And you see those tracers or those orange trailers or whatever they call those. And it seems like this, that's the appearance of these things, of just you know. Now, these are obviously more than little punks. They're obviously much brighter. Also, it says, now here's the word lightning, that lightning flashing forth from them in as these burning coals of fire, they look like torches. Well, now there's lightning coming out of this, and this is one of the Hebrew words for lightning. So it's like a punk, really big, really bright, on fire with lightning flashing out of it, and it's going, you know, and there's a bunch of these things. Ezekiel doesn't tell us what these are for until you read to chapter 10 and you find out that these things are gathered up and they're scattered over the city of Jerusalem to judge the city. So somehow this is like God's judgment made manifest or something. I don't know how you would describe that. It says in verse 14, "The living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning." So these cherubim, as they move, remember, they don't turn when they move. They move in whatever direction one of their faces is going. It's super fast. It's just zoop, 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 zoop. And he's watching this happen. And now those coals of fire also zooming back and forth. It must have been really, I mean, just freak out. You know, I don't know. It's like, whoa, this is bad flash fog or something, dude. You know, it's like all over the place. Zoop, 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 you know, up and down and side to side and all this stuff. And says in verse 15, and this is the part where people get intrigued. "Now I looked at the living beings. Behold, there was one wheel on the earth beside the living beings for each of the four of them. The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl, and all four of them had the same form, their appearance and workmanship being as if one wheel were within another. Wherever they moved, they moved in any of their four directions without turning as they moved. As for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all four of them were full of eyes round about. Whenever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them, and whenever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. wherever the Spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction, and the wheels rose close beside them, for the Spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. Wherever they went, these went, and wherever those stood still, these stood still, and whenever those rose from the earth, and the wheels rose close beside them, for the Spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. Man, do you have an accurate picture of that now? Skateboarding cherubim, that's what you... This is some weird stuff. Each one of the cherubim has what's described as a wheel, or the appearance of a wheel within a wheel. It's kind of like bearings or something, you know, had been invented now, and you got one wheel spinning this way and another spinning the opposite direction or something. He said it's wheels within wheels. But each one was associated with one of the cherubs in that when it moved, the thing followed. Now, we see the word beside, but actually Eitzel is the Hebrew word, and it means in close proximity to. So it could have been beside, or it could have been beneath, or, you know, or it also can mean joined or near or next to. So somehow this wheel and the cherub are moving together simultaneously. Somehow they're connected in a way that Ezekiel can't see, but he does know that the spirit of the cherub is in the wheel itself. And so when the cherub goes this way, so too does the wheel, you know, and wherever the spirit wants to go, that's not capital S spirit, that's the spirit of each of these cherubs. Wherever it wanted to go, it would go, or it would follow along closely. It says the wheels looked like barrel. That's not like barrel, like more fun than a barrel of monkeys. Barrel is a mineral that occurs in lots of different colors. You've probably not heard of barrel, but you have heard of emerald. When barrel appears in green form, we call it an emerald. So emerald is a type of barrel, but it's not the only type of barrel. Interesting. I originally pictured this with wheels inside of wheels. I originally pictured this as kind of those gyroscopes, you know, how you've got lots of wheels and things spinning around and stuff. But the description of this having a rim, I did some study into this and found out this word for rim is really interesting. It means mound, or it can be brow, like the brow on your forehead, or the brow of a hill. And so as it's describing this, I'm picturing it more like if you took a pie plate and you flipped it upside down, there's the wheel, but then there's the mound in the middle of it. Or like a hubcap, you know, if you pried off your hubcap and you laid it flat on the ground, there's the wheel, but then there's what this would call the rim. I guess I shouldn't have used an automotive thing because a rim is something different. But this mound or something that's in the midst of it, and it says that... it describes them as lofty and awesome. Now, lofty and awesome, you know, that's, I don't even know what joke to make about that, but it's not actually a good translation. More literally, it should say something to the effect of these rims or this mound in the middle has height and instills fear. It has height and it instills fear. Now, you see that these things in the middle, these mounds in the middle, are covered with eyes, and that would probably instill fear in me, you know, to see this pie plate flying with eyes in the where the pie's supposed to be, you know. That's kind of scary. Plus no pie, and how much of a bummer is that? And it says that each wheel's movement was the same as the cherub because the spirit of the cherub is in the wheel, and again, the wheel doesn't change directions. So if you picture the pie plate, you know, with eyes all over the mound part of the middle, and it's zooming around, it's not turning or changing direction. It's just going, and it says it's going at lightning speed, the same as the cherub, you know, so it's like, you know, it's just all over the place. So I don't know if you're thinking what I'm thinking at this point, pie, sounds like a UFO, doesn't it? And that's what intrigues people about this, is the whole UFO deal. See, proof. UFOs are in the Bible. Well, by definition, this is not a UFO. It's been identified. It's not an unidentified flying object. It's been identified. It's been identified as the cherub or I guess more accurately, you could say a part of the cherub, definitely the container of the spirit of the cherub. It's part of the cherubim. It's not unidentified. It's identified. Now, it is a flying object, and so, you know, it could be an IFO, but that's not as cool. Let's say for a moment that what we're thinking, that it looks just like UFO. Let's say that they do look just like UFOs. I want to point something out, something that we pointed out a little bit earlier. These are the cherubs. These UFO-looking things that follow around, and they move like UFOs, and, you know, they're in the shape of and kind of going in the same places the UFOs seem to go. These belong to the cherubs. Hypothesis here. Satan was a cherub. It would stand to reason that he has the same form or appearance, maybe not beautiful now, but the same makeup because he was a cherub. So it would seem that Satan would have one of these wheels as well. I mean, it stands to reason. And we know that most scholars believe that because of when the dragon swept his tail throughout the sky and a third of the stars fell, most people interpret that when we read that in Revelation as when Satan fell, a third of the angels fell with him. And you can make a pretty strong case for that. That when a third of the angels fell with him, you know, you don't know how many cherubs there are or how similar other angels. There's the seraphim, which also might be another word for cherubim or not. It might be a totally different creature. And angels and however else you want to describe it. Here's the idea that, and again, purely hypothesis. Don't go to work and say, Pastor Ron taught us what UFOs are. But here's my theory, and I hold to it pretty strongly, but you may think I'm out to lunch, and that's okay. I'm going to have pie. That the appearance of UFOs, and it's getting to the point where you can't really deny that people are seeing UFOs. I mean, you know, for all the hoaxes, for all the people that threw their toy in the air and took a picture and stuff, it's like, you know, a couple of years ago, yeah, that happened, you know, a couple of years ago, when you read in the news that all the citizens of a town, I think it was in New Jersey or somewhere, you know, see these things in the sky, and you've heard all these paranormal television shows talking about it, you know, in the skies over Texas, 500 people report seeing this weird thing, or, you know, and for all the weather balloons and hoaxes and psychedelic drugs and however else you write it off, people are seeing what they're calling UFOs. And my contention is that once you erase all the hoaxes and the secret military planes and whatever else you want to do, my contention is that we are not seeing visitors from another planet. We're not seeing spacecraft coming from some other galaxy. I believe that what we're seeing is not an extraterrestrial, but an extra-dimensional being. Not the spacecraft of a being, but the being itself. That's my contention. That's my belief. It's a pretty firm belief, but again, you know, take that for what it's worth. And the reason I believe that, number one, is it sure sounds awfully close when you look at Ezekiel. But also, we're told at 1 Timothy 4, verse 1, Paul warns Timothy that the Spirit explicitly says that in later times, some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits. Where's the deceitful spirits? You know, we can say, well, the doctrines of demons, that talks about it. But, I mean, this specifically is talking about spirits that deceive. If the wheels contain the spirit of fallen angels, how are they deceiving? Well, you've seen the paranormal TV shows, and you've seen the interviews with people and maybe read the interviews with people that claim to have been abducted by these things. And it's a pretty scary figure once you start reading the statistics of, I think it's the average of 3% of Americans claim to have been abducted by a UFO. I mean, that's pretty big. I mean, once you take all the psychos and stuff out, you still got 2.9%, you know, or maybe you got 0.1%, I don't know. But when they're coming back and saying, I've been communicated to by these extraterrestrial beings, they're coming back with surprisingly similar stories, and their message is the same. Now, never is the message, we're giving to you warp drive. We want to teach you how to make a phaser, you know, set it to stun. We're going to teach you about the tractor beam or the graviton pulse, you know. It's nothing like that. It's never anything technological. It's always religious and philosophical, always. The message is always this idea that the, this is a really common one. What mankind is perceiving as God, a singular being God, is not one being at all, but a combination of very powerful extraterrestrial light being energies. Satan appears as an angel of light. And these people are being programmed to believe, oh, the idea, man's idea of God is all wrong. No, it's these light beings, and there's a number of them. And the message is universal about mankind's evolution, the next big step. We're about to hit this next big step of evolution, and we're going to attain what we believe is godhood, that mankind needs to accept and realize our godhood, and that all the religions of the world are going to become one. What business do aliens from Mars have telling us that all our religions are going to become one? And mentioning Jesus specifically, as many of them do, saying, no, Jesus was a human that through a blip and whatever attained mankind's evolution about 2,000 years early, and that's why we don't understand any of his teachings. And, I mean, very odd that they're not trying to tell us, well, this is how you can give grain and wheat to the whole world. They're saying, no, your idea of Jesus is wrong. Your idea of God is all messed up. And here's the deal. You know, I don't think we're seeing intergalactic spacecraft. I think we're seeing interdimensional beings is what's happening. And that these are deceitful spirits. I believe these are deceitful spirits. And more Bible teachers are becoming convinced that the end times scenario, there's what's called the lie. We capitalize T and L, the lie. There's one lie that somehow, when the Antichrist rises to power and he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God with this lie. And this lie is going to be so powerful that every Muslim on the earth is going to say, oh, wow. We were wrong. We believe him. And every Buddhist on the earth is going to say, oh, wow, I was wrong. I believe him. And every religion still around, with the exception of the faithful Jews and those who have become Christians, are going to believe this. This is a big lie. What's the lie? I mean, that's pretty major. That he, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says that for this reason, when he manages to deceive most of the whole world with his story, that he, for this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false. That's one major lie. What's the lie? More and more Bible commentators and teachers are starting to see and to believe, and again, it's not set in stone, but the fact is, the whole world's bought into this idea of evolution. But let's face it, evolution doesn't hold water. It doesn't even work in the water, you know. It doesn't hold up to scientific scrutiny, because if you study the DNA, it cannot form by itself. And it shows evidence of intelligent design. It's like holding up a shrink-wrapped package of Microsoft Office and saying, yeah, it just happened. You know, it's like Silicon Valley blew up and this flew out. Because the DNA is the programming language. It's the software for the hardware of all life. And life doesn't just happen. It doesn't just happen. And so while the dull masses say, yep, evolution's true, no scientist worth his salt is standing up there saying, oh, evolution is an absolute truth as it stands. The majority of them will admit in their own circles, they don't believe it as it stands. Now, they still believe in a form of evolution, but an intelligently guided evolution. Imagine, if you would, that the Antichrist lie is, well, we've been seeing UFOs for all these years. Well, there are beings from another planet, and they are our creators. You see, 10 million years ago, or half a billion years ago, they came and planted the DNA in the primordial ooze, and so they are our creators. And now they've come back, now that we've evolved to a certain point, now they've come back and they want to, take us to this next level. And what a convenient explanation for, say, 3.5 years before, every born-again Christian on the earth just disappeared like a transporter beam got them. You know, they just got zapped. They're gone. Where'd they go? Oh, well, you see, the aliens told me that too, that they were the closed-minded ones keeping us back from the next step of evolution. You know, and it seems so out there, but if you look at human history and you look at where we're going and the Bible scenario, every detail of this fits into this alien/UFO kind of scenario. And so it's fascinating to watch and to see mankind accept, you know, how willing we were. You remember how willing we were, not we, but we as human beings, to believe they found life on Mars. I mean, man, we proved it. We got a rock from Mars. It landed on the Earth. We broke it open. Look, there's a little green man in it, you know. Well, in reality, what the deal with that was is this is a rock. It might have come from Mars, and this may show evidence that this rock had some form of microscopic organism. That doesn't sound like we found little green men on Mars to me. We can't even prove the thing came from Mars, much less that this wasn't actually an organism, or that the organism was formed on Mars as opposed to here. It's just silly, but we're so ready to, you know, buy into the Star Wars and Star Trek and whatever else. It's like, I think 100 years from now, mankind would be surprised if we don't have a close encounter of the third kind, you know. So those are my thoughts on the whole UFO deal. And like I said, you can take that for what it's worth. Biblically speaking, these wheels that seem to look like UFOs are associated with the cherubim. They contain the spirits of the cherubim. Biblically speaking, there is a lie that the world is going to buy hook, line, and sinker in the future. Biblically speaking, yes, there are deceitful spirits in these end times seeking to deceive as many people as possible. Do all those three things go together? I believe they do, but again, that's where I take three biblical facts and I say, look, they all fit together. That's for you to decide and pray through and all that stuff. So the rest of this chapter we'll look at next week when the throne of God appears. There's an expanse. The throne of God appears. God himself appears. And then the following week, we'll look at chapters 2 and 3 of Ezekiel's commission into the ministry. Let's pray. Lord, lots of information, lots of confusing things we're trying to make sense out of. And Lord, I don't know, short of getting to see in person these cherubim when we get to heaven, that we'll ever even just begin to fathom what they look like. But it's exciting to read, Lord, and gives us a reason to delve into the rest of your word and research these things and find out as much as we can. Lord, I pray that you would continue to cause us to be students of your word, that we would search the scriptures thoroughly and diligently to make sure the things we're told are true. And Lord, we just, every day is a new adventure when we're walking with you. And so we just anticipate exciting things happening tomorrow and the next day and the next as we continue to walk this walk with you and watch you unfold your plan for the mankind's future. So we commit ourselves to you, Lord. We pray that you would bless us and keep us, and that you'd cause your face to shine upon us and keep us in peace most of all. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.